You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hey, you ready? You grab that right there.
Are you ready?
Hey.
Is you ready?
Ready.
You say you ready?
Oh.
Whole squad ready?
Ready.
Is you ready?
Huh?
Are you ready?
Ready.
Is you ready? Whole squad ready. We came here to see Jet. What you got?
Yeah. You know, if you use music like this, you're legit, right? Hollings, does that make this program legit or what?
There you are. I just got your voicemail the last time I called, and I was like, oh, maybe he's just tired of me.
No, I was in D.C. for the marathon, and when I go, I have to take one component of my studio, and that is the interface between the mixer and the my cell phones that I use to call you. And so when you hook that interface back up, if you forget how you did it the first time and you plug it into the wrong things, then the electricity doesn't work.
This sounds to me like one of the litany of reasons why I'm not capable of running a podcast.
You know,
the
podcast is not a problem because you can just say, okay, hold on. But when you do it live,
yeah.
Not so much. It's called on-air producing, and it sucks. It sucks. But now everything's good. And you know what? I actually had an epiphany. I think it was during the middle of the night because I was thinking about this. Okay, I've got to get in there, and I've got to put, like, that piece together. And I said, you know what? But I don't rightly know what cables go to one slot, what slots. And then I thought, why haven't I labeled the cable? One goes to one, two goes to two, three goes to three. Why haven't I done that? Good question, right?
I think it's because in your head you've told yourself that you're just going to learn it. Because I make the same mistake about me all the time. I tell myself, I'm not going to do this to make my life easier because I need to take the harder path and learn. And then instead what I end up doing is mitigating that for the next 3 years, you know, because I never did learn. I've always been too busy, and I always just try to get it done so that I can get it done, you know?
Right. So I will fix that after the show today. I will, because it's not really that difficult. It's this plug going into this jack, but the problem is there's four cables that plug into two phones, and I need to unscrew that. But that was the issue. Let's talk about some news headlines before we talk about stuff. You want to talk about a Russian aircraft carrier that was in dry dock sinking, and I completely respect that. Have you ever seen the Marine Corps Marathon?
I've never seen it in person, no. For years, I aspired to run it one day, but I think that dream has died.
You ought to run the 10K.
That might be something I could do.
Because let me tell you something.
Don't get me wrong. I'm certain that I could cover 26.2 miles. I could do it fast enough anyone would still be there to see me finish.
Well, do you think you'd do it in less than 7 hours?
I think I could do it within a week.
let me just tell you something. I was blown away and moderately embarrassed that I was standing there watching it, covering, and people that had set out 6 hours ago were finishing a marathon.
It's an incredible accomplishment. It really is.
But they look like some of the guys look like they. So do the math, right? 7 hours times 60 minutes is 420 minutes divided by 26.2 miles equals 16-minute miles, okay, for seven.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable pace to be able to. Honestly, I would reasonable and maybe still too tough for me, but that's a reasonable pace for 26 miles in a row. That's really good.
But I was – so I was over – they have like a runner's expo when you check in and pick up your packet and your number and all that. And they have all this cool stuff. Semper Fi Fund is there. Travis Manion Foundation is there. All these awesome organizations. There's no prize money associated with race. You run through D.C. You finish running up towards the Iwo Jima Monument. right? It's like way cool. There's all these Marines out there. You cross the finish line. You run between this gauntlet of Marines that are all high-fiving you and screaming and yelling. It's, and to watch how emotional people get, and people are, instead of high-fiving and saying thank you, they're shaking hands with Marines and saying thank you for what you do, thank you for your service, thank you for being here, thank you for, it's, and you're just watching going, whoa, this is pretty cool. 30,000 runners.
That's amazing. That's fantastic.
So I would tell you.
You know, I've got a bunch of buddies who go every year, and I always see their pictures all over social media. And I think that's part of why I always wanted to do it, was you can see the culture. You know what I mean? It's so apparent that you can see it in the pictures on Instagram.
Right.
There aren't a lot of just positive things left in this world. You know what I mean? I'd love to
Let me tell you, I hate to sound like a dork about it, but when all else around you is failing, and it's good to schedule shots of love in the room and hope into your life. And I will tell you what, that is one. And you see amputees running. You see hand cyclists, you know, competing. You see people pushing people in wheelchairs in it. You see all this cool, you see Gold Star mothers running it. You see, and you meet them, and you're like, holy shit, there's all these good stories. I just wondered if you had ever seen it. Okay, so write that down, Hollings Marine Corps Marathon.
I need to, if only, and this is really going to embarrass me, I've been to D.C. twice, both to go to Walter Reed for medical reasons. I've never really seen D.C., I've driven through the city.
Okay.
But both times I was there on orders. One time it was literally flew in one morning, flew out that afternoon. So I've never really seen D.C. It's a travesty.
You're a loser. You need to go. First of all, you need to go, and you need to take your daughter when she's old enough. And
absolutely.
And because
I am. I've been to 25 countries. I've been to more other countries' capitals than I've been to.
Right.
Than I haven't been
and you
got to
go. You got to go to our museum. Our museum's a way cool event. It is. I went back again. They opened the Medal of Honor Theater, and they showed this movie about the Marines. The best part of the movie is the sound effects, man. When shit explodes in the movie, you're looking around like, whoa, what just happened? It's awesome. And the footage is pretty cool. But then this year, they have all this art from World War I. The Marine Corps had all this art sitting in warehouses. And the museum has now, you know, absorbed it. And it's really cool to go walk through. And so our museum is an awesome museum. So the Army's trying to build one. Right.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Right. No. Yeah. They're building it right up the road.
Might be a little bloated, but
right. A little blue. No belt. There won't be any belts or anything restrictive there. But they're building.
I guarantee you it'll have a hell of a cafeteria.
Exactly. But it's up right up the road at Fort Belvoir. So it'll be kind of interesting that both of them will be in proximity and whatnot. So I would recommend that you put that on your list of things to cover. And even compete in. Run the 10K. Because, like I said, it's this very cool party that's going on throughout most of the day. But there's so much good stuff going on there. I was embarrassed I hadn't been before, and whether I run it next year, I think if I want to run it, either the 10K, I don't know that I can run a marathon. I don't know that I could physically do it. But I will tell you this. There's guys who look like they just walked out of a liquor store and said, oh, what's this, a marathon? Yeah, I'll run it. Here, hold this 12-pack and hop in and
run
it.
That's true. But you know as well as I do that some guys are just phenoms. You know,
these were not phenoms. These guys had guts, shitty running shoes on, and I'm looking at them like,
but
dude.
That's what I'm saying. I was writing about rugby this morning, and it's got me in this mode. But I played rugby with some guys. Back home in Vermont, you know, farm boys. These are not guys that are in shape because they go to the gym. These are guys that are in shape because they lift hay bales at work all day. And a lot of these guys are fat and schlubby and will run circles around me. You know, I call it the Warren Sapp build. Where, like, you're built like a refrigerator made out of thumbs.
Yeah.
But for some reason, you are just an athletic phenomenon. you know? And I think that there are more of them out there than we realize.
No, these were not, this is my point, and this is why it was embarrassing. These were not athletic phenomenons. These were athletic, these were athletic disasters. But they, and
well, good for them then. That's fantastic.
Oh, you know? And that's what you, I stood there and watched everybody finish till they closed it. And it was really cool. It was really cool because at first they're all runners that finish. And then you go through kind of runners, and then you go to this phase where these people are not runners. And they've just done 26.2 miles. Now, I've humped 26.2 miles with the pack on and all of our shit. That's not easy. And these people did a pretty good, a pretty quick pace for a hike, right? Kind of a walk-run
thing.
Yeah,
I would agree, you know?
A kind of walk-run thing. And
my comfortable jogging pace is about a 10-minute mile up to 3 miles. You know what I mean? When I go out now for a run, I can maintain a pretty solid 10-minute mile for three, maybe a little bit more than 3 miles. If I want to push myself, I could probably pass a PFT and then die at the end. But, you know, when I'm just going out now, but I can't imagine maintaining that when I hit that 3 mile mark, because that still is my upper limit. I hate running the long distance. 3 miles is still my top. When I hit that 3 mile mark, I'm like, I'm done.
Right, I'm out.
I'm done. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, where's
this is as far
and you're
the
looking,
told me I'd ever have to run.
And you're looking for the finish line at like 2 miles. Where is that thing? Is it in sight
yet?
Right?
Absolutely.
And so it's humbling. It's humbling. And you see some of the older women that run it, and I'm like, ooh. So anyway, you should cover it. It's a cool event. Why do you think a publication like Military Times wouldn't have an article about it?
You know, I hate to say it, but because positivity doesn't really sell. You know, positivity doesn't really draw a ton of traffic. I jump on opportunities to cover positive stories whenever I can. But without question, those positive stories are always our least trafficked stories. People go looking for things to be mad about. You know, I think this speaks to something that we talk to often, all the time, this culture that we have in the United States of kind of like animosity and team picking and wanting to be upset. We really love outrage. So when you write a story about something really good happening, people who were involved in that good thing are interested and they want to read it. But like that guy, you know, who just got up and he's, you know, reading the news in Utah, I don't think he's intentionally picking and choosing, but we tend to click on the most outlandish and outrageous headlines to be the, you know, the 5 minutes that we spent on the toilet this morning scrolling through the news. It's tough to convince people to want to feel good. It didn't used to be that way. I hope it doesn't stay that way.
No, it is.
But right now, it's really tough to try to convince people to want to feel good.
But it's your business, right? It's your business. And so it's kind of an interesting story because I talk about it all the time. You're part of the media, as am I. The president's laying it to the media these days. And I think with, although many would push back and say he's public enemy number one, I don't think he is. I think he's part of a problem. I think he's just as big of a part as people like Maxine Waters are. In fact, I think people like Maxine Waters are a bigger part of the problem because, and I've said this before, maybe smart people might understand when she says confront, she means, you know, if you see these people, go up and tell them how you feel and don't mince your words, right? Well, when she says confront, get in their face, what do the stupid amongst us think that means?
That's exactly right. And that's exactly the problem.
Right. And then nobody, people don't come out in her own party and condemn her for saying that kind of stuff. And then the president does what he does. And then these stupid things happen. I mean, I said this too, Alex. But for the grace of God, right, if that dude goes in the right gate at that baseball field, he kills 20 congressmen in a cage.
Yep.
But for the grace of God, that didn't happen. And that doesn't stop. Okay, so let me ask you. Let me frame this in a question to you. So none of that slows down the hate and the media-fueled coverage of the truth doesn't really matter so much as it matters to be first. So what you're talking about is, you know, happy stories don't sell. good stories don't sell, because that's not going to get you where you need to be on the list of how do we do today. Oh, Hollings wrote a story about the Marine Corps Marathon. It's like not even in the top 50 from 3 weeks ago. All right, somebody needs to talk to him. But so-and-so did a piece on whatever, Rippets and PTSD, and that thing's crushing it, right? And most of it's speculative on his part, but soft science sells. Yeah, tell him good job. All right, I'm out.
Yep.
Talk to me about living in that world. How does it change?
Honestly, it's a continual frustration. It's a point of conflict. I would argue probably for the editorial team of every website out there. You know, we are constantly squabbling amongst one another. I wouldn't call it squabbling. It's always unfriendly terms. We have to try to find this balance between we need people to click on our articles. We need them to come to our website. But we also really want to produce good content, and that's not always the same thing. You know, I wrote an op-ed a few weeks ago that was kind of accusatory toward our readers, and I was really glad to see that it was well received. But it basically said that bias in the media is by and large by popular demand. There's a reason why CNN and Fox News are both such huge news conglomerates, and it's because people like hearing from their team. People don't want to go and be confronted, you know, by opposing views or by views that they find offensive. People don't want to hear that their team is the wrong team or that anyone on their team made a bad call. This identity politics idea that we have, people like it. That's the reason why it works. You know, fake news gets spread on social media so quickly because we're sharing it. We blame Russia. You know, we blame Facebook. We blame Twitter. But the truth of the matter is, we're the ones clicking retweet and share. We don't want to take responsibility for it. But ultimately, it is us that fuels this negativity because we like it. You know, so as a journalist, it's really hard. I tend to, and this is insider baseball, it might make me sound terrible. I really do. Sometimes I'll write a story where I'll go, honestly, this is just a really cool video that people are going to like. So I'm going to run this as a story. And then that same day, maybe I'll write a 2,000-word analysis piece about the People's Liberation Army's attempts to modernize overall and how it's really kind of all focused on their Navy. The analysis piece that I spend 6 hours of my day on isn't going to do as well as the video of,
right,
you know, a Su-27 doing a real low flyby pass.
Right.
You know, I was quoted in the London Times a few weeks ago
about
my analysis of a video of just a low flyby of a fighter jet. You know, even a newspaper posting a screen cap of the video, you know, that's what people want. They want to see the fighters come in low. You know, but then, you know, I'll spend weeks, months putting together an analysis piece that people aren't interested in because it's not sexy. You got to find that balance. You got to balance producing sexy content, but then also producing content that, you know what, maybe only 6,000 people are going to read this. But so, I want those 6,000 people to be better read. I want them to understand the topic better. When they close this article, I hope that they go, oh, you know what, next time I see a piece like that from Alex Hollings, I'm going to click on it.
So
I try to use multiple metrics for success.
Got it.
That's not always traffic for me.
You have to have a certain amount of credibility before you can't before you can't be a slave to traffic, yes?
That's exactly what I think.
Okay.
I agree. Because every time I write a story, I try to tell myself that the guy reading it, some important guy, is going to read this story and he has no idea who I am and he's never seen my work before. That's my hope. My hope is that, for instance, last year, a senator from Alaska, I can't remember his name off the top of my head because I'm a bad person, but a senator from Alaska almost read my piece verbatim in front of a group of generals at a Senate defense hearing about Russian expansion in the Arctic and how we're not doing enough to counter it. His aide reached out to me before he went on and said, hey, man, you should watch C-SPAN because the senator is going to be using your work. I watched it, and it was one of the proudest moments of my life. That story got 1,200 views.
Is that good?
You know? That's bad. That's terrible.
Okay.
That's real bad. 1,200 people, you know, saw that on Facebook or something and clicked on it. Whereas, like, I had other stories get 60,000 views just because, like, you know, a girl's bearing midriff in the feature photo.
Right.
So it may have only gotten 1,200 clicks, but it also manifested an actual change in our world. American generals had to answer my concerns in an open hearing.
We love that.
That, in my opinion, is a metric for success. That it's hard to calculate. It's intangible. But in my opinion, it is success. So you need to balance the ones where it's like, okay, I'm just going to try to like get enough traffic to make sure my paycheck keeps coming. But then I'm also going to do this real hard-hitting analysis that maybe isn't for everybody, but still matters, you know? Balancing it is tough, but I think that you have to be credible.
Okay. So let me ask you the follow-on question. This is where I'm leading you. This is under the guise of I lured him in with a piece of bread. How important is the truth to journalism anymore? Okay, and balance.
I think that you're falling into a common trap here.
Okay, hold on. Balance truth versus speed in journalism. And because so if I'm going to skew to be successful, this is what I would tell you. All right? Speed is more important than fact. All right? Midriffs are more important than substance. And so if I'm going to skew to be successful, I'm writing midriff pieces, and I'll use that euphemistically. So if I'm going to do politics, I'm writing hot content, right? I'll subordinate the facts to the headline, to the headline or the allegation, and I'll go with it, and being first is always better. Okay? Answer me that.
I think you're missing one element. Okay. You're missing one element, and that speed is vital, but it's not as vital as reach, especially when it comes to news distribution from independent news outlets. So a couple weeks ago...
First of all, explain reach. Define reach for us so we can have this conversation.
So what reach really is your ability to get a message to people. So Facebook's a good example. Let's say you have a Facebook page for your bakery.
Right.
You know, so people can go and like your bakery. When you post something from your bakery, like let's say, hey, there's a sale on cupcakes going on Sunday. You post it, you assume all 500 people who like your bakery on Facebook will see that, right? They don't. Facebook's organic reach dictates that maybe 1 to 3% of those people will see it. So out of 500, you're going to get 15. You know? Now, if you want to pay them $5,
right,
they'll show it to 100 of them. If you want to pay them $50, they'll show it to all of them.
Right.
And if you want to pay them $150, they'll show it to people who didn't even click like anything. You know, that's how Facebook makes its money. So that reach really ends up being the bread and butter for a news organization. You know, NewsRep's got, I think, something like 600,000 fans on Facebook. So when one of my articles gets shared on Facebook alone, I get, you know, some percentage of 600,000, which is still quite a bit, right? Now, on my page where I've got maybe 2,000 fans, and I share it on there, I don't get very many clicks off of me sharing it on my page.
Right.
So that reach is really what matters. So now when you're a big outlet like CNN with millions of fans on Facebook, millions of followers on Twitter,
right,
a television channel, when you publish something, you may not be the first to publish it, but you can very easily be the first that most people see publishing it. That's why reach really matters. If you're just an independent journalist, like let's say I didn't work for NewsRep and Popular Mechanics, I just worked for me.
Right.
And I did a bunch of digging, uncovered an incredible story,
yeah,
and I published it on alexhollings.com.
Right.
I've got maybe 2,000 fans on Facebook,
yes,
so I published it on my Facebook page. Maybe 50 people see that article.
Right.
CNN figures it out 6 hours later.
After they read
it.
After they read your story.
After they read this is a big in the media. Everything, this is kind of a crass phrase to use, and I apologize, but the media is a circle jerk. One person does the work, and then everyone reports on that work this week.
Right.
Next week, maybe it'll be a different guy, and then we all run in a circle. Right. So they read that story, but they certainly aren't going to want to say we got it from someone's blog. So they're going to say we figured this out all on our own. They run the story 6 hours later, but as far as the world is concerned, they broke it. Right. It happened to me in a real way a few weeks ago when a Chinese national was captured, I think in Belgium. Turns out he's a member of China's equivalent of the CIA and had stolen a bunch of documents from a large defense contractor. I have a lot of friends in the defense contracting industry. I used to work in that industry. I made some calls. I figured out very quickly that it was GE Military Aviation that the documents had been stolen from.
Ooh.
I wrote the story that night. You know, I emailed my editor at 1 o'clock in the morning and was like, man, just get off the phone. I still have to use him as an anonymous source because he doesn't want to lose his job. But I've got quotes that can confirm that this was GE Military Aviation. I know what it was that they stole. Let's get this out there. It published at 8 a.m. the next morning, which was 2 hours after the Washington Post and CNN both broke that it was GE Military Aviation. And as far as the world will ever be concerned, I figured it out by reading the Washington Post. These things are frustrating at times, you know, but it really has to do with timelines and reach just as much as it has to do with speed. So it's important to be first, definitely.
Okay.
But if you have a bigger footprint, you can be slower and still be considered first. So, how do you get reach? You get reach, honestly, through clickbait. You get reach through having people want to comment and share and like your post. So if you use a headline that is argumentative, let's say you use a headline like you were saying with an allegation as the premise of the headline, people will hate share your story. They will hate comment on your story, which is going to put it in more news feeds. It increases your organic reach. So the more controversial you can be, the more people will see your work. So the process is automatically leans towards worse journalism, because if you can elicit a fight in the comment section of your post, more people are going to see it, more people are going to click on it, it's going to get more traffic. And that's the reason why you see so much vitriol on social media.
So you're not giving me cause for hope here. What is the purpose of the comment section? Because you could clearly, as my friend Mike Musselman would say, you can clearly make a case for the mass extinction of the human race by simply reading the comment section of anything on the internet. Okay, why even have it? Because it's just so stupid and most of the time disgusting. What's the point of that?
Well, I can tell you right now, if you threaten to get rid of the comment section on Facebook, for instance, if you threaten to get rid of comments under articles, big outlets like CNN and the Washington Post and the New York Times and Fox News would be animately opposed to you getting rid of the comment section because it's an important tool for them. You know, I like to pick on these guys because in a lot of ways they're made out of money. I work for NewsRep, which is a subsidiary of Hurricane. We're not made out of money. There's a guy whose phone number is in my cell phone who owns our company.
All right.
You know, like, so I tend to come down hard on a big outlet like CNN because I feel like they have enough money that they don't have to play dirty, but they do anyway, you know? However, I'm aware that there's people that work at CNN that are incredible journalists. There's really hard-working guys at the New York Times, the Washington Post, Fox News. These guys who are trying really hard to do good work. The business of media is interfering with that. How do you get rid of comment sections? I don't think that the big companies would allow you to. I would love for it to happen, but I will say this. There are times, there are environments on the internet where the comment section can be a positive place.
Right, I agree with you.
NewsRep, you know, you have to be a subscriber to comment on NewsRep, so right. I'm biased because the people who comment on my articles pay for the ability to do it. I mean, they pay for more things than that, but it's one of the things that comes with the subscription. But because of that, we have a lot of autonomy in what we allow in our comment section. You know, it's a community. It really becomes like a forum. We used to, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but when I was a kid, before Facebook and all that stuff, we had forums that you'd go onto a car forum and talk to your buddies about cars or what have you. That's what it becomes. You recognize the screen names. You get to know these people. You interact that way. In a heavily moderated forum, the comment section can be a great place for people to add important information to a story. In a non-heavily moderated forum, it just becomes a place for trolls to have a blast, you know?
Right. My guest, I did not even introduce him appropriately because of communication issues on my end, Alex Hollings. He of originally of SoftRep, now of NewsRep. You can find his work there. Also writes for for Popular Mechanics, and so you'll see his work all over the internet. H-O-L-L-I-N-G-S is how you spell the last name. First name's Alex with an A. I want to talk about some news headlines. Hey, that's an ongoing concern for me. Because, honestly,
I think it should be one for our whole society.
Well, you know, and again, I have important friends. I don't know if you know that about me. Okay.
I was waiting for you to name drop. I saw some pictures on your social media.
Yeah, check my Twitter.
That's a pretty important friend.
Check some Twitter feed, bro. The director of the race came up to me later and said, "Mac, if I would have known you were that well connected, I would have been much nicer to you." I said, I noted that, you piece of shit. And but
you know, I'll tell you, the first time I ever came on Old Marine Radio, once upon a time, the way that I introduced it to my wife was like, "You will not believe some of the other guys that have been on this show that putting me on."
Yeah, no shit, man. It's legit. And so it's interesting to have conversations with people that are really high in our government. And let me tell you, I will say, without naming names, it's a concern for a lot of people that when the direction of the media combined with the fuel of social media, the desire of politicians to win at any cost is a toxic, fuel-injected blowtorch that is consuming a lot of things, and nobody has a good feel for what changes it. Because nothing seems to slow it down, whether it's the murder of innocent worshipers in a synagogue in Pittsburgh, whether it's John McCain imploring his colleagues on the floor of the Senate as he speaks his final words as he's being consumed by cancer, is it the aftermath of a shooting at a baseball practice. Nothing slows it down. It is seemingly a race to the bottom. And not among the American people. And that's why I would tell you, Alex, go to the marathon. Because the American people, the people that you saw just helping the panhandle, the people that you see respond to disasters, the people that you saw at the marathon running for other people, running for causes, that's the America that I know, that I fought for, that I live in. The shit I see on TV of the small group of people that rule this country is disgusting to me. But I don't know what saves us from them. And so if you care to make a comment, please go ahead.
I think you make an important point about it being a small group of people. And that's exacerbated by the way that they highlight other small groups. A good example being that the entire country, you know, had something to say about Ferguson, Missouri over the past 12 months. In Ferguson, Missouri, you know, 30 idiots got into a fight. One really bad person did something terrible, and the entire country spent the next year vilifying one another over the actions of those 30 people. 320 million Americans. But we attribute every one of them to either one side of that debate or the other. When the truth of the matter is, two groups of people decided to get into a big fistfight in the middle of a park. If you took all of the flags away, if you took the Antifa banners and the swastikas out of there, you've got two groups of assholes,
right,
that came there to fight. They came there looking to hurt someone else over their ideologies. You know, I know a lot of people that I'm very close friends with, that were like, well, of course we're supposed to punch Nazis in the face. That's what you do. You punch Nazis. These guys aren't real Nazis. These guys are idiots that adopted the Nazi moniker and the Nazi flag because they knew it would get a rise out of you. These guys were not a part of Hitler's Third Reich. These guys did not put any Jews into a concentration camp. They're assholes from Kentucky that bought a flag on Amazon because they knew it would make you mad. When you decide that violence is the response to that, you're not helping our country progress in any appreciable way. So I've said it back then, I'll say it right now. If me and my daughter are in the park and you decide to solve that Nazi problem by fighting them with a bat, you put my daughter at risk. You're a bad person, as far as I'm concerned. The Nazi guy's a bad guy, too. Don't get me wrong. But he's allowed to sit there and think like an asshole.
But again, if you ignore him, remember now the subsequent events, right? they were doing an alt-right event in Boston, right? Less than a dozen people showed up for the event. Now, if you want to talk about leveraging an event, you had live coverage on CNN and Fox and the major networks, right? No, well, not the networks, but the cable news outlets. And
but
no,
nobody
showed up. It's a bunch of idiots who live in their mother's basements. And you're like,
you've seen real racism at play in your life,
shit.
Right?
Yeah.
Real racism very rarely is proudly carrying a flag. Real racism is usually quiet.
Right.
Real racism tends to be a hushed conversation at best. You know, that's the kind of racism we should be worried about in this country. The kind that keeps someone from getting a job, the kind that keeps someone from advancing in their career, or the kind that affects people's personal relationships. This idea of Antifa and this idea of white nationalists, we're talking about small groups of people. Granted, some of those people in those small groups are in positions of authority or power within our country, or have enough money to leverage their beliefs. But ultimately, just like you're saying, we're talking about a small percentage of this country that is actively tearing this country apart, whereas the rest of us fall somewhere in the middle of the ideological spectrum. You know, I think that very few people in modern America proudly attribute their political identity to one of the parties anymore. You know,
no, I think
Democrats.
I think just about most people, I think you have hardcores on each side,
yep,
right?
Agreed.
But the majority of
yep.
people, and in particular the people that elect the president, are that flowing mass in between that try to figure it out, and I think are completely turned off by partisan party. They know the issues are complex. They know the answers tend not to line up down one side, but they tend to be a mix of the two, and they're tremendously frustrated by what they see. And I think they're scared. Most people, and I think there's a lot of people like me, look at it, and they're tremendously concerned about the country. Like, where does this take us? Where does this take us and first of all, the media makes money off this, okay? Who is it, James O'Keefe and the Project Veritas thing? So this guy spies on people, right? And I don't know him. He's probably a piece of shit. Okay, but
every once in a while I see something from Project Veritas where I'm like, maybe it's good that they're doing it.
Right.
And other times I see stuff from them and I worry.
Come on.
Yeah, I'm.
One of the interviews he did was with a CNN producer, and he was talking about, he covers health. I think he covers health and dental issues, right? So he's like sitting in the back of the room when they're doing these editorial meetings. But he's in the room. And he says, they're covering the president pulling us out of the Paris Climate Accord. Big deal. And is it David Zucker, right? The head of CNN? And he says, hey, look, back to Trump and Russia. And then it was like, yeah, this is – the Climate Accord is a huge deal. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What's driving us is Russia, Trump and Russia. Chase it, follow it, cover it. And he said after 24 hours, we were back doing Trump and Russia because that's where the money is. And so
I wish I could remember what outlet it was, but there's a YouTube video that was shown on John Oliver's show a couple of years ago. But it's the owner of some prominent newspaper, and he's talking to his pool of reporters. And one of the reporters asks a question, like, you know, because he's like, we need to sell newspapers, so you need to give the readers what they want. And one of the reporters raised her hand, and she was like, well, that's difficult because we need to report on hard-hitting news that people are going to be upset to see. And what the reader wants is kittens that are trained to ride unicycles. And the owner, who was definitely vilified on the John Oliver show, and I think I understand where John Oliver was coming from. The owner was like, you need to do your part to get people to buy this newspaper
right, so
that I can afford to pay you
right, to
do that hard-hitting journalism. He didn't say it quite so eloquently. He was kind of an asshole about it. But ultimately, he was like, if nobody buys the paper, I can't pay you to investigate shit. So you need to write about those kittens on tricycles sometimes. Because if you don't, people don't buy the paper, and then you don't get to do that work.
So how are you...
How do you balance that?
So how does this all end? Because it doesn't seem to end well. And I think the president has a point. First. The media does have a role in this. The media is the fuel injector in finding the worst part. You know, you've heard me say before, the nightly news, slicked up version of Jerry Springer. It's the craziest, hottest shit to get people to click, to pad our numbers, so we to drive revenue.
The news is garbage, man. It really is.
It really,
yeah, like, I hate to say it.
No, it is. It's horrible. If that's what you think our country is, you need to get out and you need to drive the country. You need to go see the country. You need to go do the country. All right? That is not America, what you, that shit you see on TV.
Georgia was a great example of that. I came down here expecting to live in an episode of The Moonshiners. You know, like, the media had told me what Georgia was, and it was a swath of land full of uneducated yokels that don't bathe and make moonshine in their backyard. And I'm not going to lie to you, I've met a couple of them, you know? But Georgia's also full of very educated academics. Georgia's also full of politicians and lawmakers and firefighters. It's a community just like I left in Boston. You know, I'm an hour and a half maybe from Atlanta. I try my best to never go into the city. I live in a pretty small community, and even in this small community, real things happen. You know, we've got high-speed internet. We're a part of this country. But in the media, the South is depicted as just a racist bunch of yokels.
Right.
You know, the North is depicted as the academic and educated elite. You know, California is only L.A. and Hollywood. That's all you get there, unless you get to San Francisco up north. That's all the West Coast is. This is the way our country is depicted in the media, and it informs the way we see one another politically. If you voted for Donald Trump, you're probably from Georgia and a racist, right? Except the reality of the matter is people voted for Donald Trump all over the country, and I'd be willing to bet that the vast majority of them, including most of the guys I know who did, are not racist. You know, they were voting based on different priorities than the New York academics.
I would tell you that the majority of people voted for Donald Trump because they were fucking pissed at the shit that gets shoved down their throat, at the shit they see, and we're going to get more of the same with Hillary Clinton. Fuck that. I want something different. I don't care if he turns the cart over in the marketplace and throws shit everywhere. I don't care because I'm sick of this shit. That's what I think.
Know, when you turn on Saturday Night Live every Saturday night and have them tell you that the candidate that you want to vote for is a racist, and that you're a racist for supporting them, and they tell you that you're a bad person for voting for the person that you voted for, it doesn't make you go, hey, you know what? Maybe Kate McKinnon's right. Maybe Jeff Sessions really is a Confederate general reincarnated. You don't do that. You go, fuck you, Kate McKinnon. I'm going to vote for who I want to vote for.
He looks, I will tell you, you know? This, he looks like a Confederate general. You know, you could put him in a Harlan Sanders costume and stick him outside of a Kentucky Fried Chicken, throw a black mustache on him or some shit, a white mustache on him, and he would do all right.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But this is the problem we run into in this country, is that our escapism even bolsters our divisiveness, right? When we watch comedies on TV, our comedies now cannot ignore Donald Trump, because people don't go to them unless they're talking about Donald Trump. It's the reason why the Jimmy Fallon show, the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, was hopelessly apolitical during the presidential campaign.
To the point where
Jimmy Fallon was skewered.
He got his ass kicked, and his career almost ended.
So what did he do? Now he makes fun of Trump every day in his monologue.
Right.
Now, I'm on record, for anybody who's not familiar with me, I'm not a particular Donald Trump fan. I'm not a big fan of President Trump. I don't think everything the guy does is bad or wrong. I think that we need to look at these policies objectively. He's a bad salesman. But sometimes the policies are
right. Let me tell you this. I think most of the policies are right. I think economically, a $500 billion trade imbalance with China is absolutely fucking ridiculous. I think our trade imbalances with countries, you know who gets punished? American workers get punished for that shit. So you can buy your soccer ball for $2 less. Fuck that. That's wrong. Free trade does not mean get taken to the cleaners and subsidize somebody else's economy. It's bullshit. And our partnerships in the Pacific and in NATO's, those countries, they need to put up more. And he's called him out on that shit. And so I think a lot of his policies are right. He, though...
Now, let me play devil's advocate.
Okay, hold on one second. Let me finish my thought. And so I would tell you, personally, in terms of style, yeah. But look what he sucks the air out of the room wherever he fucking goes. He is playing the media game as it lays in the country today. He's not going to be Ward Cleaver for you. Okay, but he is annihilating the media at their own fucking game, and they hate it.
I agree, but there's a problem with that.
What is it?
The problem with policy chasing headlines versus headlines chasing policy is that you end up being reactionary instead of having a long plan. So, is a good example of this. China's Belt and Road Initiative is not going to make China overwhelm the American economy next year. But it very well may in the next 50, you know? China's policy of trying to declare sovereignty over the entire South China Sea is another great example. A third of all global commerce ships over the South China Sea. Bountiful fishing. China's planning for 100 years from now.
I don't think they are. Here's the thought about China has a window where everybody's overwhelmed with, oh, China this, China that, and getting into their market and blah, 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 blah. At some point, like Vietnam has, like the Philippines have, like Malaysia is, people begin to say, yeah, you know what? We don't want all that. You're trying to force feed us the meal. I want to order a la carte, and you won't let me. And I'm not comfortable with you consuming me. So you know what?
I think you're making a mistake of attributing smaller Asian nations to China. That's kind of like when I get mad when people compare tiny European nations to America. China's got a massive population that's under the government's thumb already. Don't get me wrong. There will be civil unrest. But the Chinese populace, by and large, is going to enjoy a better standard of living if they are the number one economy in the world. If China becomes the center of the trade universe, if China has a blue water...
Yeah, I think you're drunk on China, and you will find that a totalitarian regime will not run the internet. A totalitarian regime will not control the world's economy. The world will not have that. And India is behind China, right? But at some point, India will have enough economic activity there to have a population that's close to the Chinese population, without nearly the same bullshit, right? That you get with China. So I think you're a little drunk on China. I think there's a downside to China.
I think that maybe you've just forgotten what the world looked like post World War II. Post-World War II, America had the strongest economies left in the developed world. And what did we do? We loaned that money out to developing nations to rebuild. And in exchange for those loans, we didn't just get friendly nations. We got leverage. That leverage eventually developed into the United Nations, first the League of Nations, what have you. That leverage eventually developed into NATO. That leverage eventually developed into the United States being the center of the global trade universe. That wasn't that long ago. You know, like there's people.
Yeah, but again, I think you don't fundamentally understand the difference between a democracy organizing nations with shared values and then including the other idiots too with a totalitarian regime.
Shared values is not true.
With a totalitarian regime that the Belt and Road thing, right, is already a disaster.
Tell me what values we share with Saudi Arabia or the Philippines.
No,
we share very few formal values with them. We share interests with these nations. And China shares economic interests with many nations that we refuse to.
Yeah, but what they do is they do this economic extortion where you have to have a partner in China. You have to give them their intellectual property, and they take it from you.
You just need to take this loan.
Other nations are watching what's gone on in Indonesia, and Indonesia say, sorry, we're out. So I think you're drunk on China. You need to go get sober.
I think you're suffering from American exceptionalism.
No, I'm not.
That we'll always be on top when we're doing very little to stay there.
Well, I don't argue. I wouldn't quarrel with that. Because I think that we're having this epiphany of discovery, like, Oh, what do you mean? Capitalism works? You mean it didn't have to be a federal program? You mean cutting regulation actually spurred growth? Holy shit! What is this? Oh, it's called...
Those are all great domestic revelations, but they're not going to change the global trade system that's developing as we speak. You know
what you mean? You mean the trade system that you think will that China will run? That will never happen.
I think that China is...
The IMF is not going to be taken... The IMF and the UN are both creations of post-World War life, okay? China will never run those organizations because the world will not stand for that.
You're right. And instead, those organizations are just going to have less and less actual authority in the world, as we've already seen clearly demonstrated time and time again.
Drunk on China.
The United Nations has no fangs.
Oh, true that, you know, true that, but it is where we go.
Assembly.
It is where we go. You know? We're not gonna go to the eastern branch of the disunited nations in Beijing anytime soon.
No,
it
you're right.
Happening.
What's gonna happen? There's not gonna be a single shot fired when America falls to second place. One day we're just gonna wake up and not realize it. We're still gonna go to the UN. We're still gonna go and posture like we always have. We're just gonna have a lot less leverage. We're going to have a lot less power when we walk into a room, because now the balance of power on the global stage has shifted. It's no longer, right now it definitely is. The United States is the unquestioned top dog. We're doing very little to remain that top dog. We're just assuming that we'll always be. China, whether it'll work or not, I think that they've got a pretty good plan, is actively working towards being that top dog at a later date. Every time Donald Trump says that we're not going to support NATO, China inches a little bit closer to the members of NATO that don't really like us. Every time Europe decides that they want to create their own mutual defense fund because they don't think that America will defend them anymore, China smiles a little bit at the idea that America's borders are receding in Europe. You know, when we have to be cognizant of the fact that the places that we leave power on the table, someone's going to take. Russia can't afford it. China can. So whenever we leave leverage out in the open because we want to think about America first, what we're really doing is we're thinking about America last 50 years from now because we're thinking about America first today.
I think you're drunk on this China, this omnipresent, omnipotent China. China has a huge downside when you deal with it, right? And if you want look, you deal with America. Why do people come here with their intellectual property?
Because it's the largest market in the world, and it'll protect your intellectual property.
That's right. And so, to me, there's things that happen in Western democracies that you don't see in totalitarian regimes. And again, the world is drunk on China. The world is drunk on China, and I get it. Okay, I'm just saying, I think it's a window that will open, that people will go and dance, they will look at the downside to dealing with the Chinese, and the pendulum will come back to center. Will China rise as a Pacific power? Absolutely. Will China eclipse the economic power of the Western democracies and the free world? They will not do that. So that's my question
to you. Did you watch Doctor Strange, the Marvel movie?
No.
Did you happen to see that movie? All right. So in Doctor Strange,
do I look like a dork? Come on.
There's a white lady in Doctor Strange who plays the Ancient One. The Ancient One was traditionally in the comic books and everything a Tibetan character,
okay.
Right?
Of course.
So when they cast this white lady to play her, Marvel got accused of whitewashing the role. What Marvel didn't say was that they were forced to do that because Chinese government censors said they wouldn't allow the movie to be released if they depicted Tibet or any Tibetan characters in the film. So Marvel changed the plot of the movie.
They do it all the time.
To make sure it could be released in Chinese market. They do this for all kinds of movies.
Yes.
They do this every day.
They get
the
people.
The Chinese government invested $20 billion in Paramount Pictures last year.
Yeah, let me just tell you. There's a guy who writes in the New York Post. He's done research in China. His name's Stephen Mosier, and so he's a very, very interesting guy, and writes very interesting stuff. Write his name down, Stephen W. Mosier. Anywho, he talks about working at Stanford, and the Chinese government did not like what he was writing, So Stanford fired him, right? He just told a story about a guy who was he's a Chinese dissident, you know, now lives in the United States, working at NYU. NYU wants to do more business in China, right? And so, lo and behold, guess who got fired? So this is that's what you sign up for. And those are just glaring examples.
This is what I mean about China, is that people think Russia is the boogeyman because they look like the boogeyman.
Right.
Vladimir Putin looks like a bad guy, acts like a bad guy, so we are happy to call him a bad guy.
Right.
Xi Jinping also is a bad guy. If anything, he is a much more significant and lasting threat to United States interests and security in the long haul than Vladimir Putin is. Putin may be out of office in 4 years. Xi Jinping just had a law passed that keeps him president for life.
Forever.
You know.
Yeah, but they'll get rid of him. Hey, when it doesn't go well for a few years, they'll get rid of him. They'll get rid of him. He'll make enough enemies. And over time, and at some point, he will screw it up.
But you have to understand that right now in China, there's two guys on the radio having the same conversation about America and Donald Trump. Right? And whether we like it or not, perceptions of America do matter. I know that we like to be the guy who walks into the bar with his chest puffed out, saying I can kick anybody's ass. But the truth of the matter is that when you are that guy, people are less apt to want to play tennis with you tomorrow. You occasionally have to not be the guy who tells everyone at the start of the conversation that I can beat you up, right? So as America receives and the way people perceive it, as America's overall image deteriorates, China continues to get better, even though they're doing stuff like having guys at Stanford fired, because they're very good at managing their own PR.
I just think that the world is intrigued and euphoric about China. And when you look at the reality of what, and I'll tell you what, classic example right now and a marquee example is Alphabet/Google. Will not help.
That's a great example. They won't work with the DOD. But they're happy to work with the Chinese government.
Yeah, and so what do you think the Chinese government is going to do with artificial intelligence, right, in their own, like, .china.com world, right? And I'll tell you what they're going to do. You're going to hear this on your door. Uh-oh. Dad, it's the cops. It must be for you, right? Yeah, we've got a list of websites. You'll come with us. It will make for.
Oh, that's absolutely.
It'll make.
Have you heard about their social credit score program?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's dystopian.
Right, and still coupled with Muslim education programs.
Seriously.
Yeah.
But this is the concern that I have, though, is that I agree with you that totalitarian regimes like this tend not to have a significant half-life. But we're looking at that through the perspective of history, where it's not uncommon at all for a country to lose its goddamn mind for a generation or two. You know, which means China becomes a real concern right around the time that my daughter is of age to fight in that war.
Right.
You know,
well, let's talk about that. I think China has a window that the world is enamored with it. The reality of what you have to give up, what Google will give up. And if you have philosophical and value issues relative to helping the American Department of Defense, then how that in God's name can you justify, except under the guise of we're going to make a shit ton of money, helping a totalitarian regime more efficiently enslave its population? How do you make a case for that?
The reason is that your average American doesn't see China as a bad guy. They don't recognize, because they see Xi Jinping, he looks like Winnie the Pooh. He's never out there saying anything that's overtly aggressive. He's never on the news saying he's going to bomb anybody. China has stayed out of most wars of the last 20 years, which is actually kind of a downside for them militarily in terms of preparedness. China doesn't seem like a threat. So when Google's like, oh, yeah, we're going to help China's government do bad guy shit, most Americans just scroll right past that story. But when they see, I mean, the way that the program with the Pentagon was misrepresented in the media as some kind of a targeting apparatus for drones, which is utterly unfounded, people scroll past that headline. They see Google's making AI to target terrorists, and they click on that and get all pissed off. The truth of the matter is they were trying to make like a Google image search type algorithm that you could use on intelligence feeds so that one analyst didn't have to look at every minute of footage that we record from drones and other assets. Instead, they wanted to be able to say, show me every time a guy with a turban on his head popped out that door. And it would show him that. That's all they were trying to make. But the American people decided we won't permit that. The American people don't care about China. And that's why China's a threat. Because it's the one we're not looking at.
I don't know. I think you're wrong about that. I think America does view China as a threat. I mean, how can you not?
I think your average American sees China as just another player on the stage.
Yeah, Putin is. Remember, Putin chairs an economy the size of Canada.
Putin's not a real threat.
Yeah, he's a poser. All his blustering is just that.
To go back to that bar analogy I used before, Putin's 5'7"-ish. He's 5'6". Putin is the short guy who walks around looking for a fight and is so quick to fight that everybody assumes he's tough.
With a big voice.
Nobody fights with
a big loud voice. Hey, you!
Exactly.
And you turn around and like, oh, what's up, little man? What do you want? Little man, I'll kick your ass.
Kind of aggressive jokes to try to goat you into a conflict. That's who Putin is. That's what the whole bravado is. Russia uses doomsday weapons to stay in the conversation because they couldn't fund a conventional military.
Yes. Hold on. Okay, hold on. I want to talk about three issues with you. I want to take a break, though. Can you hang out?
Okay. Yeah, I can stay for a little bit.
This is Alex Hollings, all right, from Soft Rep, now News Rep, right? He speaks in a size 6 font. There's more words per an hour of talking with Alex Hollings than any other guest I have on the show. All right. And I like it that
I write 5,000 words a day, man.
I like it that we don't always agree. So we're going to take about a 3-minute break. So if you got to take a leak or anything, feel free. More of Allmaring Radio coming up next. And then I want to talk about comments. And I'm going to tell you what I think, and you can tell me what you think. A lieutenant general made last week about war with China. So don't touch that dial. More of Allmaring Radio coming up next. My guest, Alex, the one and only Alex Hollings of NewsRep. More of that next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on Allmaring Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on Allmaring Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at AllMarineRadio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue. But it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I remember walking around the court square sidewalks, looking in windows, things I couldn't want.
We continue here on a Tuesday. Alex Hollings joins me, he of NewsRip. And so we've been talking about some issues. China, we've been talking about the media, if you just joined us. Interesting discussion about speed, about reach, about where the country's headed, and the concern of a lot of people around the country, where the direction that all this leads the country, and the lack of any good answer to how does it change. So with that said, going to shift gears. Last week, a former United States Army Lieutenant General by the name of Benson said that he sees a war between the Chinese and the United States happening in the next 10 to 15 years. Now, my own opinion is that he's selling something. I don't know who he is or what he does, but if we can coexist from 1945 to 1990 whatever with the Russians, 45 years, what is the case that we're going to go to war against the Chinese? I don't get it. I'm curious about your thoughts there.
Let's say Donald Trump wins a second term in office.
Okay.
And then the next president is a two-term president.
Okay.
We're talking about a war with China in the next presidency, one president away from where we are now.
Okay.
If someone were born today, we're talking about a war with China before that person went to the junior crop. Doesn't seem likely to me. Our economies are too interdependent. You know, the United Nations and like the global stability apparatus that we've constructed to try to prevent war between nuclear powers may not have all the teeth it once had, but it's still there. It's intact. I don't think that the chances of a war with China breaking out are likely even in the next four decades. However, I think, and this is just a theory, I think that what General Benson was trying to do was say something that could evoke enough of a response to get anybody to pay attention or do something about it. I think that maybe he thinks, like I do, that a war within the next 50 or 100 years could be possible if the table is set properly, and if we take steps today, we can prevent that from occurring. So maybe he used 15 years as a bit of alarmism to try to drum up some attention
to what
topic.
To what issue? So what topic are we talking about?
Well, here's an example. In the South China Sea, China right now currently maintains what we call a green water navy, right? China's navy runs on diesel.
Right.
So China can't go further away from Chinese shores than they can make back in time to refill, right? China doesn't have a global infrastructure the way the United States does. Even the naval vessels we have that run on diesel have hundreds of friendly ports all over the world that they can steam into and get a fill-up. China doesn't have that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yes. No, it's my personal belief that that's part of what the Loans for the Belt and Road Initiative will do is when some of these floundering economies can't pay back those loans, China's going to use that to leverage some base property. They want to build some bases so that they can have those friendly ports all along the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, pipeline so that they can defend their own trade route, you know, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. It's why the U.S. is a global presence. China's going to use the economics of trade to build a blue water navy that makes them a global force.
Right.
So I think the chances that a war would break out
in China
why
do we have to fight, though? Because I don't see, because the downside of that
is too huge.
It's too huge for both. So I don't, that's why
I agree with you. I think he's selling something, but what he's selling, now it's important to note that now he works at a think tank.
Right.
You know, he's a strategic advisor now. What I think he's selling is the prospect of a conflict with China to be the boogeyman that we're worried about instead of Russia like America is currently infatuated with. China's hypersonic missiles beat the pants off of ours that are still years away from even being tested. China's artillery,
you know we're not afraid of hypersonic missiles, right? I mean, if they want to knock the faces off Mount Rushmore, have at them.
We are very afraid of hypersonic
missiles. No, we're
but
not.
But it's only at sea. We're worried about them at sea. We're worried about them with our carriers.
No, we're not.
We have the biggest fleet of carriers in the world.
We're really not.
But we still only have 12.
They can't.
I'll tell you what.
They have to acquire the target.
They do, and we have no evidence to suggest that they can or can't, other than on-land tests that we can confirm. We can confirm that they successfully targeted a Nimitz-class outline they drew in the desert.
In the desert, it's not moving, though. It's the problem of target acquisition, right, with a dynamic target.
It's something that you would need, something like maybe an F-35 to manage, right? Or kind of like the
So you got to have an
China right now.
You got to have an F-35 over it, and it's got to maintain that data link, right? And if you don't have that, you can't shoot it because you can't see it. So that's nice.
And how many times do you have to actually have a successful hit to sink all two carriers that we can get into the Pacific?
Yep.
You need it to work twice.
Right.
That's all.
No. I'm just saying it. The problem of targeting is not as easy as everybody. Hey, we have a missile.
That's true. If a conflict were to break out in 20 years, they've had this missile since 2001. You think in 40 years they couldn't come up with a way to have a good targeting apparatus?
You know what, the way that warfare changes now, it's like I remember when we got the squad automatic weapon. This thing shoots 1,100 rounds a minute. Okay, that's awesome. But nobody can carry 1,100 rounds.
Absolutely.
That's really fast. That's really good. How does it?
I think this is the same conversation every Marine has had with a civilian who thinks a machine gun's the best weapon to carry in a fight. Most people think machine guns are just as accurate and you can be just as selective as you are with a semi-automatic rifle, while you just have way more ammo and you can shoot way faster. That's not how carrying
assault works.
It's a suppressive fire weapon.
And it's interesting. Mike Musselman, who appears on the show, he said, I had a squad leader on for Vietnam. You should interview him. His name's Jack Riley, and he's a Vietnam squad leader in the most decorated fight that the Marine Corps got in Vietnam, maybe in the history of the Marine Corps. A Medal of Honor, 4 Navy crosses, 6 Silver Stars, and 3 Bronze Stars in a 4 to 6 hour fight, named Jack Riley. Oh, by the way, he's also an Agent Orange guy. Oh, by the way, he's also a Camp Lejeune water guy. and all she does is acts like a leader. He takes care of his Marines that he served with in Vietnam and other Marines that cross his path. He's an awesome, awesome guy. So we were talking about M14s, and he had to turn in his M14 and get an M16, and he said he's from Alabama. He doesn't live too far from you. Mac, can you imagine taking the handguards off and seeing Mattel stamped on them, some bitches? Mattel? He said, swear to God, Mattel made them. So we were talking about the M4. Mike came on, and we were talking about the M14, and he said, you know, it's hard to talk about when they say that that was a great weapon, because the M27 right now, you know, we talk about, you know, shooting 7.62 rounds in the dirt in front of somebody to suppress them. How about this with the M27? How about I just shoot him in the head? Will that suppress him enough for you?
Right. Yeah.
He said it's completely different, right? What we used
now,
to talk about
and I
some of
what you're
talk about.
I do. Like, hypersonic missiles are just the flavor of the week. But right now, they are in defensible technology. Now, we might come up with a way to counter them in the years to come, but right now, the best way we can come up with is to build our own.
Oh no,
mutually assured hypersonic destruction.
Right. And we'll have to. And then
we're dumping billions into it, and we totally will. We absolutely will. By the time a conflict ever could happen, we'll have them too.
And that's okay. So the interesting dances, the most interesting dances on the planet now, are both economic, right? The president says he doesn't think China's ready to talk yet. Let me get my secret decoder ring about tariffs. Let me get my secret decoder ring. If you've watched every economic statistic that's come out about China's markets, right, and what's going on there, they are getting the shit kicked out of them. The president
their currency is the lowest in 10 years right now.
Right, and the president is going to let them swim in it for a while because he's trying to teach them a lesson. Hey, you need us. We need you. Deal with us as an equal. And we need to deal with this $350 billion to $500 billion trade deficit, because that ain't right, and the American worker is paying for it. So, and then with Russia, right? This what brought down the Soviet Union was that they did not have the hard currency to maintain their defense industry. Okay.
Ronald Reagan sent them into the grave.
Exactly, and so President Trump. He's looking at Vladimir Putin and saying, do you really want to go down this road? It did not end well for the people that inhabited your part of the world last time you did this. Okay.
Well, I mean, we're currently doing it. The sanctions that we've put on place in Russia since 2014 are one of the reasons why the Admiral Kuznetsov, or however you pronounce it, has been in his dry dock that I just sank in.
Okay, hold on. First of all, tell the story, because Alex, when he came on before the show today, he was telling me how wonderful he thought the story was. Tell the story.
These kinds of stories warm my heart, right? So having an aircraft carrier internationally is a sign of military power and prowess, which is why Russia still maintains one, even though they don't have any money. So the Admiral, I'm going to butcher this, Kuznetsov, I always just call it the Admiral K in my head when I'm writing, Russia's single aircraft carrier. It's a sister ship to China's Leonov, their first carrier. They've got two more in production now. But these were built in Ukraine before the fall of the Soviet Union. And then when the Soviet Union fell, they unloaded one hull to China, and then they finished the other one to make this Admiral Kuznetsov. This thing is so unreliable that it has not been out to sea in decades without a tugboat, because they know it's going to break down, and it's embarrassing to have your carrier adrift in the Pacific Ocean. So for the last 2 years, it's been in dry dock, or for a long time now. It's been sitting there standing by waiting for an update that's supposed to make it some kind of formidable seagoing vessel again. But Russia has had to continually siphon all the money out of it lately for nuclear submarines, because they really think that's the future of their defense apparatus. So this thing's been sitting in dry dock. Last night, the dry dock sank with the carrier in it. The carrier apparently survived, but cranes
wait a minute. Say that again.
So the dry dock that Russia's only aircraft carrier has been in sank with the carrier in it.
Oops.
The carrier survived the sinking, but with formidable damage to the deck, to the flight deck, to the bow.
First of all,
crane fell on the flight deck.
When the dry dock sinks and the ship's in the dry dock. A ship in a dry dock is completely opened. All the hatches are open. Everything is open. There's no anybody doing damage control because it's in dry dock. All right, they're
dry dock. You're not worried about it.
They're not supposed to sink.
Especially when they don't have the money for you to be working on it. You know, like, there were people aboard the carrier, and they were able to get it buttoned up before it took out too much water to sink with the dry dock.
Somebody's
this is hilarious to me.
Somebody's getting their ass
kicked. This is a good example of sanctions that we put on Russia after their annexation of Crimea in 2014 are working. Russia's economy sucks. Russia's defense budget has gone down 2 years in a row, not because Vladimir Putin's not focused on defense, but because there is no money. The biggest, you know, we're worried in Europe about whether or not NATO could respond to a massive Russian incursion. I'll tell you now, they couldn't. Not in time to protect the Baltic states, at least. What's protecting the Baltic states from Russia is Russia's economy. They couldn't sustain a war, so they're not going to go to one. We're all real worried about Russia. Russia's not a threat at all. To go back to what we were talking about before, though, China, I don't think it's
a threat right now. Hold on. Let me make this point. The importance of NATO and NATO not being on the same footing that the United States is, but being either average to a little bit above average is when they are a little bit above average. There's nothing the Russians can do. What is Russia going to do to the countries of NATO that are moderately well funding their defense? The answer to that, they're not going to do shit. They can't do shit. And I say the same thing in the Pacific. The importance of our alliance out there, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Australia, and then throw in kind of bit players like Vietnam and the Philippines, you have China effectively hemmed in. China's trying to break that. And they will do it because they have the money to buy a blue water navy. Okay, but when you look at it,
the geographical locations of those countries you just listed are important because they would allow us, really, to establish a naval blockade around China. And that, just like you were talking about when it comes to tariffs and stuff, China imports a great deal of food every day. As just one example, China imports more oil and food than they export. That means they can't support their population without imported goods, which gives the United States Navy a lot of leverage in a future conflict. Just another reason why I don't think a war would break out. You know? I mean, a naval blockade around those allies, bolstered by the land masses provided by those allies, would be enough to stop the flow of a lot of stuff to and from China. You know, they'd have to rely on land, and that's a whole different bag of bananas that they're not prepared for. China, within their country, has to use their commercial trains to transport their army, because they don't even have troop transport equipment that can move their own military within their own country. Another reason why we're not going to go to war with China in the next 15 years, guys.
Yeah, I think that's ridiculous. All right, we got about five.
I think you were right, man. I think he's selling us on an idea. You know.
Right. I think
whether or not it's the right idea, it's questionable. But I think that's what he's trying to do.
All right, tell me what you're going to. I wondered, and again, Xi Jinping, I saw this quote this morning, and I thought he said it in response to what that army general said, which was prepare for war in the South China Sea. I don't know if
that's... He was saying it to his own staff.
Right,
you know?
Right. I didn't know if he was... That was a public statement that he was saying just for like, okay, well, if the Americans are going to talk this shit, then I can do it too. So tell me what we're going to see next from you.
Well, for me, first and foremost, I just wrapped up an op-ed that's called Geopolitics Made Simple, You're Just a Guy in a Bar. And it's kind of speaking along the lines of that metaphor I was using earlier, attributing different world powers to just people you know at the bar. Geopolitics are not complicated. The reason why they seem complicated is because you don't know all the variables at play. When you walk into your local bar and you see that girl, Claire, that you went to college with 30 years ago, haven't really talked to her much since, but you do remember her. You don't consciously inventory your relationship with her. You just glance at her and remember whether or not that's a person you want to go talk to, whether or not they'd be friendly to you if you approached, and whether or not you think that they're a threat to you in some way. That's how geopolitics works. The thing is that the players are just in the bar every day. So it's really, it's kind of a primer to just kind of try to take away some of the intrigue associated with foreign policy and explain it in a way like it's just people. It literally is just conversations between people that we in the media tend to blow up into pomp and circumstance that makes your average American kind of not interested. So I'm hoping it'll explain it in a layman sort of way that shows that these people aren't smarter than you. These people aren't different or better. They're biologically the same. This is just what they do at work instead of what you do at work. Some of the other stuff, you're definitely going to hear about this Russian aircraft carrier thinking, man, I love this story. I've got a couple of different stories in the pipeline. You're going to find something on Popular Mechanics in the coming week about the Saturn V. Just a retrospective into what led to us building what I think is the greatest engineering marvel humanity's ever managed to produce. I've also got an interview with George Wallace, who was the submarine commander, who co-authored a book called Firing Point that became the movie Hunter Killer that's in theaters now. I talked to him about the reality of submarine warfare, how it's depicted in movies and how that kind of doesn't always accurately represent the way real warfare plays out. And I spoke to a few Navy SEALs to get their side of the story when it comes to the CQB that you see in the movie. So I think that story will be real cool. You can find that on Popular Mechanics probably within the next week.
All right. There you have it. I've taken up a lot of your time this morning. I'm not going to apologize, but
hey, man, I'm always happy to come on here and talk with you.
No.
Honestly, I look forward to this all week.
Well, that's a sad commentary on your life, but I will take that. Let me tell you, I read a lot about China. I love reading about the economics in play here. I believe that we need to economically confront countries that I believe economically exploit us. And I'm not exactly sure. I think an interesting article would be, how did the United States make so many bad economic deals that essentially disadvantaged American workers? You know, did we do that intentionally to prop other countries? Was that a foreign policy decision? And it couldn't be a straight up economic agreement because we've got to help stabilize these countries as well. Why did we do that? What's the rational basis for that? Because I think the evaporation of the American middle class is something that we ought to all be concerned about. And the exportation of what used to be jobs that supported households is something that we all ought to be concerned about, because if there's only two classes in the United States, there's going to be trouble. If there's only this upper middle class of elite people that have solved the code on leveraging the internet to acquire wealth, and then there's everybody else who does service jobs that support them, that does not bode well for a country. What has been the bedrock of the United States is a large middle class. And so I think our economic treaties are undermining that. And so I think the president's in the right direction. And so it'll be interesting to see the economics play both with Russia and this treaty. The treaty's not so much about missiles as it will be about economics at the end of the day.
One of these days I would love to have a talk with you just about the things that we can do to try to offset this. You know, one good example rings in my ears every time we talk about the disappearing middle class is that my generation grew up being told you have to go to college to have value in our society. It's not true. I mean, I'm a guy with a master's degree telling you that. It's not true. I mean, what we need in our society are people who are willing to work. Whether it's with an education behind you or if it's with a trade background behind you, whether you work in the service industries or retail or as a dentist, we need people who will work hard. But we've taken the idea of the blue-collar, middle-class guy, and we've made it shameful, and that is disgusting to me. You know, a plumber, electricians, carpenters, these are the guys that build the world we live in. Guys and girls, excuse me, that build the world we live in. And we tend to discount them because they don't have the diplomas hanging on their wall that I do. I'll tell you right now, my next door neighbor's a welder. And if you want to talk foreign policy about China, I'm probably your guy. But if you want your pipes to stop leaking, he can help you.
And if you want somebody who's making a pretty good living, look, I know guys that are plumbers. I know a guy who's an electrician that says, I'll match my paycheck with anybody that I graduated from high school with.
Man.
I run my own business. There's not going to be any demand shortage. I turn work to other people. But, and so, no, the trades are huge. The trades are huge.
I promise you the guy that I just paid to come and retile my bathroom for money tonight. I promise you that. You know, like, but we have this cultural stigma associated with being a guy who comes home from work with dirt under your fingernails. And I think that that's one of the things killing our middle class.
Yeah, no, those to me are fascinating subjects. And again, if there's an old saying in military stuff, you know, amateurs talk tactics, pros talk logistics. To me, in foreign policy, right, amateurs talk issues, pros talk economics, because economics sustain nations, and it is the economics of all of this, and that's why the president's very content. Like, you haven't seen him making grand overtures. He wants China to choke in it. He wants China to see the necessity of a stable, reciprocal, good arrangement with the United States, and the economics are on his side. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, all right, you're right, man, because of all the structures that we've built, none of them will survive the flow of money. All the political structures that we've built, all the diplomatic structures that we've built, they all exist at the whim of the way currency is flowing. If there's money in something, rules will change.
Right.
So you're 100% right. Economics is the language of the world. It really is.
Right. And so it's interesting to watch it play out in this political world with these dynamics that kind of swirl on a daily basis. And again, I'm not the president's biggest fan in terms of style points. Here's what I think Donald Trump does well. I think in terms of policy people, there's nobody with more credibility in that administration than the Secretary of Defense. He goes around the world, and I'll tell you what, and I think he doesn't have any problem going to the Chinese and standing on his hind legs and saying, we're not going away. We won't stop this. We need to come to an agreement like we had with the Russians that we can both exist. You are not going to shut down the South China Sea to us simply because you say it. It ain't happening.
I tell you what, James Mannis reminds me of the Emperor in the Star Wars movies.
Oh my God!
You know, in the original.
Why do you keep talking about movies that I don't know about? The Marvel movies.
You don't know about the original Star Wars trilogy? Don't even play, man. You've seen the original Star Wars trilogy. You may not be a nerd, but you are a human and an American. I know you've seen Star Wars. James Mattis looks just like the Emperor. Sunken eyes, mean look on his face. You know, when that guy walks into a room, you have to assume he's willing to cut you. You know? I love James Mattis. I'd vote for him for president, but I don't think most of America would. Unfortunate.
I don't know. There'd be a lot of people that love his plain spoken way.
And I tell you what, if you see all of a sudden, and I don't predict this, this is just a hypothetical, if Mueller comes out with something that's impeachable a week before the primaries, you'll see a Republican challenge Trump at the primary. Otherwise, you're not going to see it.
But
if it looks like there's a chance Trump gets impeached, you're going to see a Republican challenger at the primaries. I would love to see a Mattis Haley ticket, but I don't think that's what we'd see. But I do think the only way you see a Republican challenger is impeachment.
Well, which, you know, and again, impeachment is simply the articles of impeachment. What do they have to pass?
No, impeachment is no guarantee of being removed from office.
Right,
but no one's going to want to run into an election.
First of all, no matter what happens in the election, there will never be the votes in the Senate to do that. So it won't happen.
Donald Trump's never going to be removed from office.
Right.
100% true.
So he may be impeached by the House.
He may be impeached.
What's the threshold to pass that? Is that straight majority or what?
Oh man, I'd have to look at the numbers to be honest with you. I want to say that I know the right answer, but I don't want to give you the wrong one. But I don't think it's just a majority. I think that it was a super majority, but I'll have to confirm. At any rate, Donald Trump's not going to be removed from office, in my opinion, until the end of his term or somebody else gets elected. However, I don't think that it's improbable or impossible that someone would be able to push an impeachment through. Now, if I were smart and I were a Democrat, I would hold that impeachment off until the election campaign, until he was running for re-election. Then I'd put it out there so that I could make people think a vote for Donald Trump might well be a vote for his vice president. If you can convince people of that, then I think that you've got a really good chance of putting another Republican up there in the primaries. I think the Democrats are in a better position to win overall. I'm not suggesting that Robert Mueller would play that kind of political card. The timelines could converge. Someone in a position of power could make it happen. But I think that's the only real reasonable chance you'd see a different Republican on the ticket for 2020, as if the articles of impeachment prevent Donald Trump from winning the primary.
I'm looking.
That's my prediction.
That's my prediction. I'm sticking to it. Also, the House will adopt a resolution to notify anyone. All right, sir. I appreciate your time. Good luck riding today, and good luck with the Kuznetsov.
I appreciate it, man. It's always a pleasure to be out.
All right. There you have it. Alex Hollings. He of NewsRip. He of Popular Mechanics. All right. Have a good week, man. I'll talk to you.
You too.
There you have it. Alex Hollings. Fastest talker on all Marine Radio. We'll take a break. We come back. I have a number of questions about the Boston Red Sox. And we'll talk. So we'll talk a little bit of World Series baseball. I did not. I'm catching up. Okay. I did not get to watch all of it. You know, East Coast baseball watching sucks. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that when we come back. Next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is if you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue. But it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Mac, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away. carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.